And welcome back for another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. My name's Natalie Sambi, and I'm an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. And today we're bringing you a very exciting podcast about Indonesia and regional security, featuring three distinguished guests who have been speakers at the Conference of Australian and Indonesian Youth in Jakarta today. But before we get to that, we'll be back after this short break.
Feliz cumpleaños or happy birthday to us. Sea Control is 1 year old. That's 1 year of bringing you quality content every Monday. We've done a lot of growing up together, figuring out how the editing software works, making things the right volume so we don't sound like garbage, and adding our friends from Phoenix Think Tank and the Australian Strategic Policy Institute to our lineup. We've interviewed Eric Prince of Frontier Services Group, Ian Gardner of 45 Commando, and many US, European, and Asia-Pacific naval thinkers and leaders. This is our present to you. Perhaps you might consider a present for us. Remember to subscribe, rate 5 stars, and tell all your friends. Sign up for SIMSEC as well at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Read some of our articles and consider writing some yourself. Today may be our birthday, but the Maritime Security Party goes all year long.
And welcome back. As I said, we're here today with three distinguished guests who have been speakers at the Conference of Australian and Indonesian Youth, who've been talking today about relations with Australia and Indonesia. But we'd like to explore a little bit more than that. Indonesia has just elected a new president. So with a new president comes a new foreign policy and strategic policy. And there are a number of pressing security challenges in the region, not to mention adjusting to China's rise, changing demographics in the region, economic nationalism, acquiring defence procurement in the region, increasing submarines, Japan's perceived militarisation, and really, where does Indonesia fit in all of this? So, talking with us today, we have three guests. Our first is Mr. Jim Jalajikoma, who is now a senior fellow at the Australian National University, formerly of the International Crisis Group. We have Lieutenant General Agus Widjojo, who's a retired member of TNI, who's had a number of distinguished positions both in the military and in the Parliament, and we also have Brigadier General Gary Hogan, also retired former defence attaché to Jakarta of the Australian Army. Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Natalie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. What I'd like to start first and foremost is this question of Indonesia and its future. With its new president comes perhaps a new foreign policy, a new strategic policy. I'd like to ask each of you perhaps to comment on where you think Indonesia is going. Gary, first, would I ask you?
Well, thanks, Natalie, and it is great to be here in Jakarta at the Conference for Australia-Indonesia Youth. It's also, I think, a happy coincidence. We are here on the 15th anniversary of the Indofet force into East Timor. Now, those 15 years have seen breathtaking political and cultural and economic change here in Indonesia. And I'm very happy to say that the Indonesian Defence Forces, or the TNI, Tentara Nasional Indonesia, has transformed in total lockstep with the amazing changes that we've seen happening here in Indonesia. The TNI, 15 years ago, would not have possibly rated as highly as the current Defence Forces do in all the public opinion surveys conducted by Kompas and others on the most respected and revered institutions here in the Republic of Indonesia. It's an exciting transformation journey, and certainly my hope is that the Indonesian TNI will continue that transformation. It's a very interesting demographic happening these days. The next batch of Indonesian majors to go to staff college, the Army, Navy and Air Force staff colleges here in Indonesia. That demographic, those majors will have spent their entire careers under reformasi. They will not have any memory of a military in or under the new order, the Order Baru. So I think that it really is a very encouraging time these days to see Indonesians and its military transform into a truly national armed forces. And I think that that's one of the great challenges for the new incoming administration, is to make sure that that transformation continues.
Pak Agus?
Yes. We have
just completed our election, the election for the members of parliament and the presidential election. I think democracy is very well entrenched in the Indonesian public, that there is no way of turning back. Although that in its infancy, we see the opening up of various aspirations, and this is where the challenge lies, where in our traditional culture in the past, where we see differences has to be converged and put into one definition of what right is and what truth is. Now we have to live and manage those differences in a sort of consensus as one basic tenets of democracy. And I think Indonesia will progress and continue with the progress of democracy. And although that President-elect Jokowi will face challenges, but there are great expectations there, because President-elect Jokowi in his campaigning and in his initial efforts to establish or formulate his policies have already involved people from the younger generation of Indonesians, well-educated, those who have international experience. We hope that Indonesia can position itself better or continue as what President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono has established in his two terms of presidency.
Jim?
One of the key aspects of President-elect Jokowi's policies is the conceiving of Indonesia as a maritime nation. This has both a domestic and a foreign policy dimension to it, because Indonesia wants to make the most of its maritime resources and to protect those resources. And so one of the issues that will arise is that Indonesia's exclusive economic zone does overlap with the mythical nine dotted lines of China, China's claims in the South China Sea. It's a difficult one to issue to resolve, and will require some deft diplomacy. But Indonesia was a key country in the formulation of the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. And the nine dotted lines have no basis in international law. But I think it's not quite a conflict between claimant and non-claimant states. But it is an issue of disagreement that does have real implications in terms of illegal fishing or controlling fishing resources. And it is a focus of the Indonesian military to safeguard these national resources. And so the new administration will have to grapple with this issue, which is part of the larger, the greater foreign policy issue of the rise of China in the Asia-Pacific region.
On the issue of maritime security, and Jim, as you alluded to, it is the focus of the Jokowi administration. With each of you, your lengthy experience both in defence realms and security policy, I'd like to ask each of you what you think the Jokowi administration might start to do to address some of the challenges of diplomacy in the South China Sea, or to address some of the challenges of things like illegal fishing. Gary?
Thanks, Natalie. Yeah, look, I you would be aware that once a year, or once every couple of years, we do have a coordinated operation, a CORPAT, between the Royal Australian Navy and the TNERL, the Indonesian Navy. I would love to see those coordinated patrols extended to at least twice a year, one in the eastern end of the Indonesian archipelago and one closer to the Indian Ocean. I think that the more that we get to understand the habits and the procedures and processes of each other at sea, the better it will be for our ability to coordinate and cooperate in a maritime sense in our shared region. I've said before that Australia has a very, very key interest in the freedom of passage through Indonesian sea lines of communication and trade routes. We get almost all of our petroleum from out of Singapore through the Indonesian archipelago, and it's very, very important to Australia that we keep those trade routes open and free to trade. The other aspect, of course, is that Australia has just purchased two very large landing helicopter dock, or LHD. Australia is not good and does not have a history of ship-to-shore operations in a sort of a Marine Corps sense, as the US knows it. However, the Indonesian Armed Forces have had a Marine Corps since the 1940s. We have a lot to learn, I think, in terms of our ship-to-shore operations from the Indonesian Navy and the Indonesian Marine Corps. It would be fantastic, again, if we could invite some Indonesian participation as we start to unfold and develop our own thoughts on over-the-shore logistics, over-the-shore, and the sorts of operations that we could conceivably be involved in the future. If there's any future humanitarian requirement to do that, such as we saw in Aceh on Boxing Day in 2004, I think it's incredibly important that we exercise in a humanitarian response scenario with Indonesia.
Yes. I think the first thing that the new Indonesian government has to do is to enhance or increase the effectiveness of its internal arrangements in maritime security. Right now, what we have is only an overarching coordinating authority over those resources and assets being given to this coordinating institution from the various institutions, like from the Navy, from fishery, from forestry. It has not proven effective in carrying out these and observing and supervising the control of the natural resources of Indonesia. I have seen the model of Australia, where if this coordinating institution could be stepped up into a full command authority, while giving it the authority to operate these various assets and resources from the various institutions, to be integrated and operated in a coherent way, which can be proved, or hopefully to improve the effectiveness of this operation. With that way also, any cooperation with other countries can be done in a more efficient way, because there is only one door policy to be entered or to be contacted, so that any cooperation in the realm of maritime security could be conducted more effectively.
Jim?
Indonesia is very proud of its role in the creation of the UN Convention of Law of the Sea, and I think it should have a role in continued diplomatic advocacy for a rules-based order. It has great authority to do so as an archipelagic nation as well. And it shouldn't be doing this alone, but working with other countries to try and manage the conflict in the South China Sea, to understand that it will be difficult to resolve, but it is in nobody's interests, because of the importance of these sea lanes and the importance of these natural resources, to fight over them, or to create armed conflict over them. And so I think this can be done at many levels, direct diplomacy by the government itself, or through Track 2 efforts that Indonesia has done for many decades now, and continuing that dialogue. This is an issue that is not going away, and I think viewing it as something to be managed rather than resolved will be an important issue for the new Jokowi administration.
Thank you. Gary, just to tap into some of your experience here as essentially a defence diplomat, you know, a lot of the challenges we talked about with the South China Sea are to do with, ultimately, with China's behaviour. You talked earlier about China moving through the Indonesian archipelago. What are some of the challenges in trying to communicate diplomatically with China? Or do you have any suggestions for how, you know, we might strategically communicate in a much cleverer way in order to sort of dispel some ambiguity about our actions and intentions and China's actions and intentions in the region.
Well, yeah, thanks, Natalie. That's a very important point. And how we handle China is an issue of mutual concern to Indonesia and Australia. We're here in some quarters that China will rise peacefully and will become a very responsible member of the region and the global community. And of course, there are other voices that also add their views that China will actually rise in a method that would actually threaten some of the global and regional security institutions that we currently have in place. Only the future will tell. In the meantime, people ask me, how does Indonesia view its relationship with China? And of course, I always tell my Australian colleagues that it's a very, very similar construct, a very similar model to the way that we deal in Australia with our relationship with China. On the one hand, China is our largest trading partner. It's an incredibly important relationship for Australia at the political and economic level. But at the same time, we have to keep, a weather eye on developments in places, as Jim has said, like the South China Sea, as indicators of how China might rise and might become part of the region. My advice to Indonesia would be to simply keep options open. And certainly, I think Indonesian foreign policy currently towards China is very similar to that of Australia. And I think let's wait and see what happens in the next 5 to 10 years. But China's rise and, of course, the US rebalance to Asia, those two streams of very broad strategic trends ongoing as we these days in our region. The two keys, I think, to how the strategic relationships between and among Southeast Asian and Southwest Pacific nations will play out. So my advice is to just keep a weather eye on China's intentions, both signalled and less signalled, into our region.
So thank you. But Agus, I might actually turn direction, and so now that we've talked about the diplomacy side of things, I'd like to turn a little bit to the hard power side of things and discuss the Indonesian military. You've obviously had a long history of reform and talking about military reform in the past and democracy. I'd like to ask you, what are the priorities you think for the Indonesian military going forward, forward either in terms of modernization or in terms of reform, in order to be able to, you know, become commensurate with where Indonesia's strategic weight and economic growth are heading?
Yes, relatively strategically, we do not have much time. I think both have to be done simultaneously. Reform is all about putting the military in the proper role and authority in accordance to the 1945 Constitution. And if we assume that the 1945 Constitution mandates for a democratic political system, then reform is essentially putting all the defense institution under the principles of democracy. It is not about abolishing or defending. It is not about changing. And if we recall that 1945 Constitution never mandated for that dual function, any role beyond the traditional military role of external defense. So we can say that reform of the TNI is essentially not a change, but a repurification of the role and authority of the TNI consistent with the mandate of the 1945 Constitution. So that is for the reform. Now, if that reform is already in progress and to be continued to be completed, simultaneously, we also have to prepare to build the proper defense posture in accordance with the dynamics of the strategic external international environment. With that also, we have to start building a credible and appropriate defense industries, and which we are starting now. So both have to be done simultaneously.
And just before we move on, could I just ask you to comment on the level of Indonesia's naval capabilities? What are the priorities you think there that must be addressed by under the new administration?
I think it all hinges back to the focus or gravity of the traditional Indonesian defense posture, which traditionally hinges on the focus of internal defense and land power. Into the future, by considering more of the characteristic and nature of the Indonesian geopolitical environment, I don't think there's no other way that we have to shift into the required capability of the Indonesian defense posture, and that is to be able to observe if there are, or in the event of any hostile military power moving towards Indonesia. So we have first to identify them before their approach. Secondly, is that preferably before they land in our islands, we have to be able to destroy and repel them on their way in their sea approaches. So that would take again a build up of naval capability, and I think that would be the basis of the strategy and a direction where we have to build our naval capability. First is to be able or the capability of surveillance and reconnaissance. Secondly, the detection, and thirdly is to disrupt, destroy, and repel any hostile military that intends to invade Indonesia.
Thank you. Jim, I'd like to tap into some of your experience at International Crisis Group and some of your work previously. Now moving to defense engagement. In the past, the United States has cut relations with Indonesia over issues of human rights abuses, and now we've got some 15 years of the Indonesian military under a democracy, but yet still questions remain about accountability of the military and human rights, even today under the Jokowi administration. I just want to ask your comment and your thoughts perhaps on the situation where Indonesian human rights are concerned and the military, and what might the Jokowi administration do to address some of that?
There's been a lot of pressure during the campaign for the Jokowi administration to address some ongoing or unresolved issues of domestic accountability, be they surrounding the events of 1998 or going right back to the turmoil in Indonesia in 1965-1966. I think these are very big and difficult issues for this country. I think in the international sphere there is always a debate regarding peace versus accountability, and there are different camps from that. My previous organization, International Crisis Group, we were an organization that prioritized peace, because with peace comes stability. Ending violence was seen as a priority, and accountability was a secondary issue. I think as Indonesia shows, it's a difficult issue. It's a multi-generational issue. It's not something that will be resolved by outside sanction. It is something that needs to be resolved in the community. There is domestic pressure for that, and this will be one of the many issues that will be on the plate of the Jokowi administration. It's not as it was during the Suharto era and the New Order. It's not swept under the carpet. It's out there and being debated, but it's not yet being resolved. I think that's something that Indonesia needs to grapple with, and trying to sort of influence that from outside won't necessarily be helpful. I think it's a good thing that Indonesia is democratic, it's stable, it's just conducted a series of election events with almost no violence that it should be proud of. And that is really established Indonesia as a democratic country, and it will resolve these issues of accountability through probably lengthy, complicated democratic debate.
To my other two guests, do you agree with this idea that peace comes before accountability?
I think, as Jim has said, there are still a lot of unresolved issues that hangovers from 1998 here in Jakarta, from 1965 across the whole archipelago, and certainly issues still, I guess, hungover from 2000 and, the East Timor Intervention Force. Again, I think that's very important for many people to gain closure on those events, but I guess I'm more focused, and I hope that the Jokowi administration will be more focused on the future. And I think, really, when I looked at how the Indonesian armed forces comported themselves right throughout this amazing general election, presidential election that Indonesia has just completed, when I look at their current track record in places like Papua, I'm really kind of reassured that that the Indonesian leadership of the armed forces and the Indonesian junior leaders out in the provinces and doing their work on a daily basis, I think there's a different kind of dynamic at work. I think there's a different responsibility and appreciation of their role as the armed element of the armed force of government and government policy. I hope that the Jokowi administration encourages that, and I hope that that current trend will continue. Of course, it certainly will expand the art of the possible for Indonesia's participation in things like the United Nations peacekeeping operations, which it currently contributes so well and so fulsomely to in places like Congo and Lebanon and Haiti. But it also, I think, will expand the art of the possible between my own country, Australia, and Indonesia's ability to jointly exercise, to jointly train, and to swap and compare notes on how to maintain stability and security in our shared region.
It depends. What events do we refer to in trying to reach accountability of those events? If those events are still, let's say, warm, in the sense that the perpetrators are still alive, the hard evidence can still be assembled, the victims are still available, then if that requirements if those fills the requirements, then it should be followed by a court process. But even this is not easy, because we have been told that it is not easy to fill those requirements. Now, for those events that happened way back in the past, like the 1965 tragedy, I agree that the Indonesian people has to come to an agreement to close the history of the past and move forward. But to close the history is not to forget. To close the history is also to be able to find lessons learned. Why did it happen? I think that would be the focus of the method that we would opt or choose, and that is to be able to come to a finding what actually happened, that in the Indonesian society we were able to kill our own brethren in such big numbers. Something must be wrong. That is very important to come out with lessons learned. And what is most important is that to be followed by institutional reforms, so that those kinds of tragedy or events should not happen again to the generations of our children and grandchildren in the future.
All right, just talking there about reconciling Indonesia's past, but I'd like to turn a little bit now to the future. And as three individuals who live in the Asia-Pacific region, I'd like to just finish up now by asking each of you what you think the great security challenges are for our Asia-Pacific region. If I could ask you each one by one, and just a very brief comment on each of those. Gary?
Yeah, I guess almost counterintuitively to me, I don't believe the great security challenges in our region, and particularly for Indonesia, revolve around necessarily defence and security. I think the great security challenges are more in the area of employment and education and health. It's in some ways it's probably a shame that the centrepiece of our two nations formal treaty-level relationship is built around defence and security. I think that's very, very important, and certainly that dates back to the time of Paul Keating and his relationship with President Suharto, and the foundations, I guess, which set the current glide path for our bilateral relationship in the current time. However, I would love to see the Jokowi administration and the new Australian government talk more broadly and more expansively about how we might better cooperate to ensure a level of prosperity and stability and security and continuing democratisation here in Indonesia off the back of things like huge agreements to cooperate in things like education and health and technology transfer. I don't think that Indonesia in the current era can sustain the sort of resources-based and agriculturally-based economy that it currently has. I would love to see Indonesia more literate in technology and to be part of, I guess, in a defence element to this. I would really love to see Indonesia, with its incredible history in the aeronautical and aviation industry, it'd be great to see Indonesia benefiting from some technology transfer and therefore playing into a kind of a global supply chain. I don't just mean for military aircraft, I mean for aircraft all around the world, and to really carry on that legacy of President B.J. Habibie's area of expertise. I'd love to see a more expansive relationship between our two countries, extending further than just defence and security.
Yes. I think it comes from two opposite situation. One situation is an excessive ownership of something, and in this sense it's a prosperous economy. One is the deficit on anything else. Deficit on food, deficit on health. On the excessive ownership of prosperity, it would be interesting to see how countries who have those capability would use those capability as a responsible member of the international community. In the deficiency, we ask the question, who would the international community be able or have the capability to come to assistance to those countries to give them assistance as part of the international community. Then comes again the situation that we do not have a world government body who has the authority to regulate all those. And if there is no regulator, then what would happen? The ultimate question would be how to enforce any countries with a specific extraordinary situation that country would still be able to behave as a responsible member of the international community.
And lastly but not least, Tim?
I think the big issues of security writ large go to sustainability of economic growth, to go to climate change. These are issues that will only be solved collectively through cooperation between nations, and so trying to subordinate these border disputes, these conflicts that get in the way of that sort of consensus building, I think will be one challenge. That how can China grow as an economy, and we will all benefit from that, but how can it grow sustainably and grow without sort of triggering conflict with all its neighbours as it tries to acquire the resources that it require that the it needs. So I think managing the sustainable economic growth without sort of promoting physical conflict, I think will be one of the challenges for the region.
Excellent. I think we'll wrap it up there, gentlemen. I would just like to thank you all for sharing your time and expertise and providing a lot more depth to an understanding of Indonesia, a dynamic and increasingly growing country in Southeast Asia and growing strategic weight in the Asia-Pacific region. Thank you very much again.
Thanks, Natalie.
And don't forget, you can catch past episodes of Sea Control on iTunes. Thanks very much for listening in today, and we hope to catch you again soon.